friends.
Okay, so our speaker for tonight is Dr. Matthew Benton. And Matt is a friend of mine, and he's doing a postdoc here with the New Insights for Religious Epistemology Research Group, I guess would be the title, with John Hawthorne and other others. And he's also a JRF at Somerville College, and his work is in religious epistemology or epistemology. So I'll, I guess, pass it over to you. And Matt's going to talk for a bit, and then we'll have a discussion, and I'll probably hop back up and help kind of chair that or field questions. So.
Thanks for having me. I'm just going to give maybe 20 minutes or so informal remarks on what is basically just a primer for those of you who didn't have introductory philosophy and didn't do much theory of knowledge or epistemology. And I'm going to try and cover some territory that's fairly uncontroversial amongst professional philosophers, and which is sort of background for wanting to apply some of these issues to particular questions in religious epistemology and raise some new ones that are actually also not very much discussed, even amongst philosophers of religion and religious epistemology. When I say religious epistemologists, when I say religious epistemologists, I don't mean epistemologists who are religious, I just mean, although most of them are, I mean epistemologists who work on issues of religious epistemology, religious belief, religious knowledge, evidence for religious belief, and so on. So what I want to do is talk about that a bit, raise a few things, and then open it up for questions, comments, objections, whatever, particularly if there's something that's bugging you about something I've said or something that looks like it's a clear application to your own work. I'll say also, I have a bit of a background in theology, so those of you who have some theology in your background or do some theology right now, I find a lot of this very pressing for those of you who work in these areas, particularly because theologians often don't have they don't have the time, but they also don't have sometimes the background to take much attention or care much about what professional philosophers think about, how they think about epistemology in these topics, particularly most recently. So what is epistemology? Epistemology is the branch of philosophy that deals with knowledge and especially related issues concerning belief, evidence, reasons, credences. Most of what I'm going to say tonight doesn't have to do with credences. Credences are sometimes known as subjective degrees of belief. And the notion of belief we're working with tonight is primarily that of on-off. You either believe or you don't. It's a kind of mental state of full commitment to what you regard to be a fact. In the parlance of professional philosophers, the object of a belief or of knowledge is a proposition, which is just an abstract entity that represents the world in a certain way. So sometimes I'll slip into this mode of using a variable like P, which just means any old proposition. And so a proposition is just this thing that we believe, which we hope when we believe it, is the way the world is. A proposition can be true or false depending on how the world is. If the proposition is that it's raining in Oxford right now, and in fact it's not raining, then that proposition is false. See how that goes. Don't be misled by that kind of language. Most of the stuff we're going to talk about today is very close to home, because we use these terms, knowledge, knows, believes, every day. And so what we're going to be kind of doing is a bit of like conceptual archaeology here to get underneath what it is we all actually understand the logic of, but which we sometimes don't pay much attention to. One of the ways we can get a handle on what knowledge is and how it relates to belief and, say, evidence or reasons or truth or whatever is by noticing the occasions where we're comfortable attributing knowledge to people and the occasions in which we're comfortable denying knowledge of people. And one of the interesting things about knowledge is when we claim knowledge for someone, we're actually making two claims at once. We're making a claim about the subject, the person who's the putative knower, but we're also making a claim about the way the world is. So how does that work? Notice that we're perfectly happy to deny knowledge or just be disposed to deny knowledge of someone when we take it they don't even believe the proposition in question. So for most of you, I know a few of you, so I can't say all of you. Most of you, I'd be perfectly willing to deny that you know what street I live on. The reason for that is just, I just don't think you would have even thought of that matter. You wouldn't have formed a belief on the matter. So just on the basis of that, I can deny you knowledge of where I live. Now I might be wrong about that, but it looks like I'm well positioned to be able to make that claim. And the reason for that is just I know that you don't likely have a belief about where I live. Same for me. I mean, you'd probably just be disposed to deny that I know where you live, because unless you're one of my friends, like, you know that I haven't even met you, probably, let alone formed a belief about where you live. So these facts make it look like belief is required in order for you to know something. If we'll deny it when we think you don't have even the belief, right, and we're only willing to attribute it when you do have the belief, looks like knowledge requires belief. Right? There you can run little linguistic tests to test this as well. So you can note that it looks bad. It sounds almost incoherent to say, Susan knows that John is in his office, but she doesn't believe that he is. Like, that should strike you as absurd. Because the second thing that I said looks like it just takes away from the first claim. Similarly, if I do it in the first person, I know that it's raining, but it's not. Or, sorry, that's wrong. I know that it's raining, but I don't believe that. That's just, you just wouldn't know what to do with that sentence. Like, if I told you, I know I have a tutorial tomorrow, but I don't believe that I do. You should wonder what on earth I'm trying to say to you. So it looks like knowledge requires belief in this way. And so we've already made good on one part of this world to subject fit thing. The claim that's made about the person is that they believe a proposition as being true. Okay. Good. But what about the bit about the way the world is? So it looks like we're also perfectly inclined, and rightly so, to deny knowledge of someone of a proposition when we ourselves know that proposition to be false. Or even if we just think it to be false. So suppose that it's last summer and I know Jonathan's a big World Cup fan, and I say, I think, for some reason, maybe I don't know, that Jonathan thinks that the World Cup was being held in Argentina, when in fact it was being held in Brazil. Well, under those conditions, it'd be absurd for me to say, Jonathan knows that the World Cup is being played in Argentina, but in fact it's being played in Brazil. Right? That's not going to make a lot of sense. Also, just take two other people. Like, I wouldn't be able to say of two people know propositions which I know to be incompatible with each other. So if I say, Max knows that the meeting is on Wednesday, but Sue knows that the meeting is on Friday. Assume it's only one meeting a week. That those two conjuncts don't look like they can be true together, right? Because you can't know two things if one of them is false. I mean, I'm hoping you're having these same kinds of reactions. Maybe you're not, and if you're not, we can feel free to raise these kinds of questions later. There's also a very easy first-person version of this, which I actually slipped into earlier, which just goes, I know that it's raining, but it's not. It's like you're not going to know what to do with that speech. So it looks like knowledge requires not just belief, but truth. A claim about the way the world is. And now we've made good on both bits of the idea that knowledge claims two things, so something about the subject and something about the way the world is. You can see why, because as philosophers, especially professional epistemologists, sometimes sloganize it, knowledge is factive. You can't know things that are false, you can only know facts where facts are true propositions. You can't know false ones. Okay. But now, what else should we say? Well, it looks like you can't just believe a truth and have that be knowledge, because we wouldn't allow that in certain special cases. Although that might be our kind of proxy for when we're willing to designate someone as knowing. But when we find that, someone has just guessed something to be true and it is true, well, we wouldn't claim that they knew in that case. Or if you get hit on the head and you find yourself with a belief that happens to be true, that doesn't look like that's knowledge. Or if we know that someone has very good reasons, maybe knowledge-worthy reasons or evidence for a true proposition, But we know that the reason they believe it is, in fact, because their spouse believes it, and they know they don't want friction with their spouse, so they believe it because of the relational issue, wanting to do what their, you know, wanting to believe what their spouse believes. And even in that case, I think we want to say they don't know. So it looks like what we want is for the way the subject is and the way the world is to fit together in the right kind of way. And the way that epistemologists typically talk about this is evidence or reasons. And evidence or reasons look like the kind of thing that much of the time need to be underneath the kind of normative element with belief. By normative element, I mean epistemologists worry a lot about this notion they often call justification. And the normative notion encodes this idea that there's an ought involved. Sometimes this goes by the slogan, the ethics of belief. But the ought here is very obvious, I think. I mean, it looks like there are things we ought to believe and there are things we ought not to believe. And whether we ought or ought not has largely often to do with evidence or reasons. You're not believing as you ought when you believe without evidence or something. Or if you want to deny or skew the notion of evidence in certain domains or with certain cognitive faculties, maybe you just want to say, I have a perceptual capacity to be able to see objects in my environment. Maybe that doesn't involve evidence. Maybe evidence is something a bit different. Well, that's nevertheless the case where I've got some kind of reliable process that connects me and my formation and my belief to the way things are. Certain brands of epistemology often go for something like that, and they want to say the method is reliable, or the method by which you believe is safe, or something. But this is going to invoke some kind of relationship between the way in which you formed your belief and the truth of the matter, the truth that's believed. But we don't really need to get into much of that. I think it's just important to see that there's something normative. There's something that epistemologists often worry about when they want to say, how do we know something? And that how it question goes along with why ought we believe, or why should we believe? And that normative ought sometimes is cashed out in terms of a notion of permission, and sometimes it's cashed out as a notion of obligation. So there might be cases where you got enough evidence, you really ought to believe because you're expected to believe it in those kinds of circumstances. In other cases, your evidence might be such that you may believe, but you're not required, you're not obligated to believe. We don't really need to take a stand on those kinds of issues. The only thing that I really want to touch on is the idea that this justification or this ought is this normative notion that ties the truth that's believed to the believing and the reasons or the method by which you believe. So far, so good? Roughly, hopefully. So now we're actually at in the lore of recent epistemology, we're at this moment in the 1960s where this guy wrote this 3-page paper and demolished the idea that a lot of philosophers are tempted to, that knowledge just is justified true belief. We don't really need to talk too much about that. I just wanted to get on the table these kind of core notions and show you how they at least go together in a rough way. But we can also now raise questions like this. In the religious epistemology case, when we're talking about God, whether there's a God, what God would be like if there's a God, the conditions under which you ought or ought not to believe that there's a God, you can ask questions about whether belief or knowledge or something else ought to be the primary notion of epistemological interest here. Faith is a word that comes up a lot in these contexts. And you might even actually notice that in religious epistemology, if you're a religious person and you're, sort of a standard Western monotheistic tradition, that belief is the kind of the core notion, at least it seems a lot. But I want to postpone whether we ought to think any of those things and just get at questions about whether faith ought to be understood or could be best understood in terms of belief or in terms of knowledge or in terms of evidence or none of the above. And really to probe what just sort of from the armchair or from your background or from the level of intuition, what faith means. And it doesn't have to be just the religious notion. It can be the everyday-ish notion too. Let me just back up. There's one more thing I want to make sure I cover. When epistemologists talk about how you know something, they at least want to admit, most of them anyway, that you could know
on the basis of several kinds of processes. So a standard one for non-skeptics, if you're a skeptic, you just end up saying that you don't know very much or much at all. But what we can do instead is just kind of like retreat to like the conditions under which we are rational to believe. But a non-skeptical epistemologist, of which most of them are, will say that you can know things in lots of ways. I mean, you can know things by way of testimony. So don't you know? I mean, if you tell me something that's true and I straight away come to believe it, and maybe you have to know it, or maybe you're telling me it has to be reliably connected to the truth or something, but it looks like straight away I should be able to know it, right? I mean, that's what we would normally say. It looks like you can know by way of relying on your memories, at least, maybe, if the belief got into your storage, your memory, just in the right way. You can know on the basis of perception, right? Use that example. And looks like you can also know on the basis of inference. So there's all kinds of inferences. There's at least two kinds, deductive and inductive, but arguably a third and distinct one called abductive or inferences, that's explanation. So deductive inferences are the ones that philosophers love the most, kind of. It's like you have a tight argument, the conclusion follows by way of logical laws from the premises. So the premises, if they're true, they entail the truth of the conclusion. It's like, you can't get any better than that. And it looks like that's, if you believe the premises and they're true, then the argument would be sound, and you ought to be certain of the conclusion. Certainty is a notion I haven't yet broached, and it's lurking kind of in the background. And we don't need to go to it, but we can talk about it. Sometimes that oomph, that normative ought stuff, for some epistemologists, goes along with whatever it takes to make you certain of something. Epistemologists have kind of retreated from that idea because it looks like it's way too strong. But we can still say things about it, like potentially in the deductive reasoning case. Inductive inferences are ones where, right, you've observed, say, a bunch of cases where swans are white, and the more cases in which you observe swans are white, the more justified it looks like you are in believing that the next swan you see is white. That's the toy case that's always used. But this is a kind of reasoning that's not certain, it's just probabilistically plausible, right? The more cases of something that there is, it looks like there's something there that's helping you out to enable you to believe on that basis. The stronger the enumerative case of induction, or enumerative cases you have, you can reason yourself into believing the next one is also that way. Abductive inference, or inference of best explanation, is arguably different from induction, but the idea there is, we don't need to get into that either too much, but the idea is roughly, you've got some data and you have a hypothesis or a theory that looks like it's the best explanation of that data, the best one amongst the rivals, at least, that you've got. And in the right kinds of cases, anyway, and distinguishing those is one of the hard parts. In the right kinds of cases, that looks like the right kinds of grounds for believing that, this hypothesis or this theory is true because it's the best explanation of that data given various theoretical desiderata. It's the simplest, or provides for more robust predictions and whatever. Okay, back to faith. So what's going on in the case of this notion of faith? A first question I want you to kind of kick around in your head for the rest of this evening is whether faith requires belief. So we've been talking about propositions. Let's continue to think of propositions. When you believe that P, that's one thing. Is it a different thing if you have faith that P? And the question would be, if it's different, how? And why? Why? If you do believe that P, do you thereby have faith that P? Now, if you answered that first question I asked in the negative, then presumably this question would also be negative. So if you thought it's actually different, doesn't require belief, and doesn't even have anything to do with belief, then you might also think that when you believe, you just don't have faith, it's something else. what is the relationship between faith and evidence? And maybe you want to think, maybe it's easier here to think in the religious context, maybe it's not. But it looks like if faith is a little bit like belief, that maybe we want to say that faith involves being in a, like a less good evidential position, maybe? It's hard to say. I mean, this is going to be an open question right now. Is there a relationship, a conceptual looking relationship between faith and knowledge? That P? So if you know a proposition, can you have faith in it? Faith that it's true? Kick these around and we can come back to them when we kind of open it up. Let me make sure I'm not going way off what I said. I want to just say this stuff about faith is really unsettled territory in the professional literature and epistemology and in philosophy of religion. There are a bunch of notions that are vying for, I guess, supremacy or something, and there's been a lot of really interesting work done on it very recently. I think we just, it's not clear that what we really, really think faith in consists in. And maybe that's because it's just a multifaceted notion. For those of us who are religious believers or have kind of religious faith, it'd be nice to get clear on that, especially those of us who have a theological background, work in theology, you know. This is some stuff that we'd really like to get clear on. If it looks like there aren't these kinds of connections to maybe belief or knowledge or evidence or something, or aren't real strong ones, is faith of epistemological interest? Can we characterize it as like rational or justified in that normative language we appealed to earlier? One thing that I'll throw out there, and that is sometimes invoked, is that having faith that P, or you know, faith in a proposition, looks like it invokes the notion of risk somehow. So that if you're willing to act on a proposition on the basis of faith, you're somehow being risky with it. Maybe that's because, thing I alluded to just a minute ago, your evidential position isn't that great with respect to that proposition. So if you were to act on it, you'd be taking some kind of risk of acting on a falsehood. That's a possibility. So one idea defended by actually a friend of mine goes like this. Faith in some proposition consists roughly in stopping one's search for evidence and committing to act on that proposition without further evidence. That might sound plausible to you. On this idea that, you know, the risk involved is one where you'd like to have more evidence to take a certain kind of action, maybe if the action is a high stakes kind of one too, or more so want more evidence. But you don't have it, and so you act on faith by acting on the proposition which you, in some sense, take to be true. But it also, that notion that she defends does not invoke any kind of cognitive endorsement of that proposition. So it doesn't require belief, it doesn't require knowledge. On her account, I haven't given you the full account, just like the breezy version of it. On her account, just consists in dispositions to act in certain ways as it flows out from your preferences. So given a certain kind of case, you prefer to take on a certain action given that P, and you prefer not to not P, but you're willing to stop the search for evidence and go ahead and act as if P. That'd be showing faith that P. And you might wonder whether faith is a little bit kind of, it feels incompatible with knowledge, because knowledge is the kind of thing that looks like it's somehow safe or reliable or something. If you know, the notion of knowledge, it invokes a kind of safety method. The idea is supposed to be roughly that the truth of that, your belief being true is safe if you use that method in a nearby world that also be true. And so the idea looks like, look, if you know, it's safe for you to act on it. I mean, you're acting on a truth, because knowledge is fact. So there's no risk involved if you in fact know, and you're acting on what you know. In that sense, it looks like faith might be at odds or something with knowledge. Now, return us to like maybe closer to home territory, religious epistemology, or if you have a religious tradition, particularly if you're a Christian. It looks like knowledge, at least, is not very prominently endorsed as the relevant standard or something you have very much, maybe. And faith is. And you actually get this kind of stuff encoded right into the way the theologians and the way the creeds, right? So we believe in one God, the Father. And it's always we believe. And there's nothing there about knowledge. And it might, just the mere patterns of that might make you think belief is the operative thing, knowledge irrelevant. And belief somehow goes with faith. All right, I'm going to let you guys work it out. But here's a famous line from one of the most important philosophers ever. Kant, in the preface to the second edition of his Critique of Pure Reason, has this famous line, much abused line in some ways, where he says, "I have found it necessary to deny knowledge in order to make room for faith." And I suspect that this attitude or this sort of way of thinking about these epistemological notions is pervasive amongst religious believers. Maybe they don't all endorse it. Maybe they're happy to think that they actually know a lot of stuff about God. Right? And so that's not going to like kill your faith. But nevertheless, there's something important about this connection between faith and knowledge. I should also say, somewhere in here, if that doesn't quite fit into the structure of what I wanted to say, there are some very influential recent epistemologists, reformed epistemologists, religious epistemologists, like Alvin Plantinga, who's at the end of his career now, but Nicholas Waterstroff also, William Austin, who early on made a lot of waves in religious epistemology by arguing that, in fact, belief in God, they don't use faith so much. Belief in God is rational, not because it's based on evidence, because they argued at length that you don't actually need that for belief in God to be rational, but there's this foundationalist kind of picture about how epistemology goes, and notice I haven't actually said anything about that, but you can have a picture on which, hey, we take perception, we take memory, we take these kind of faculties we have that are sort of how basic, they're acceptable for us to rely on without them needing any justification or any kind of proof or anything, and that you can just stick certain beliefs into the foundation and that's legit. There's no problem with that. And Plantinga famously argued that belief in God is, belief that there's a God, is one of those kinds of things that can go right in the foundation. It's not rationally accessible in the way that other ones are that are built up from the bits of the foundation. But if it's not rationally accessible in this way, I mean, it looks like it's kind of difficult to claim that it'd be knowledge. Precisely because knowledge looks like it is valuable in that way on the basis of evidence or reasons or justification. So now, he's got a more complicated picture than that. And in fact, his view develops over time. I just wanted to raise that because those who work a bit in theology do at least know something about foundationalist views in epistemology and theory of knowledge. And they also might know something about faith as well. And insofar as I'm interested in probing what faith is, and how it ought to fit into a thoroughgoing religious epistemology, and how it ought to fit maybe into your own, religious epistemology, or the kind of thing you're working with. That's worth noting. I think it's also interesting, though, to note, just to kind of take back this idea. I've been sort of stringing you along as if knowledge is maybe incompatible with faith. But we get, in some places, this idea that knowledge is actually required of us by God. So, in the Jewish tradition, there's a long-standing way of interpreting the first commandment given in Exodus 20 as being two Christians. Well, different denominations even count this differently. I've been told, but in the Jewish tradition, they tend to say that the bit that says, "I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt," and so on, and then goes on to say, "You shall have no other gods before me," that's two commandments. And in lots of traditions, you actually just want to say that that's two sides of the same commandment. But the important point for right now is that arguably the most important Jewish thinker of all time, I mean, barring like Moses and stuff, Maimonides, says that the first commandment is in fact, that I'm quoting here, the first mitzvah is that we are commanded to acquire knowledge of the nature of God's existence, that is to understand that he is the original cause and source of existence who brings all creations into being. The source of this commandment is God's statement, exalted be he, I am God your Lord. Now what's interesting about that is that the longstanding Jewish tradition is to interpret that first bit as requiring either belief that there's a God, such a God that's your Lord, or knowledge. And the funny thing is, like, there's no mention of either belief or knowledge there. It's just, I am the Lord your God. So there's interpolation going on, but Maimonides thought, this is what's required of you to be a faithful Jew. You are to know that there is a God and that God is your Lord. Now they have, you know, various ways of dealing with that. I mean, you could be an unfaithful Jew by not having knowledge on that interpretation, but maybe having just mere belief. But I think it's interesting that there are sources that want to say, no, there's not this incompatibility. In fact, knowledge is the thing that you would have if you were in this right relationship with God. Okay, almost done, really. Let's also note that there are, in English anyway, phrases like this. Faith in a person or an institution. Just like there's belief in a person, which isn't where it looks like the object of the belief is a proposition. So we're shifting from propositional epistemology when we start talking about something else like this. And it might be that you think faith doesn't, the reason maybe why faith doesn't work out in the categories that we've been sketching before, belief, evidence, knowledge, and so on. It's precisely that the notion of faith, where we say, in the creeds we might say that, we believe in God, the Father, the Almighty, is that that's actually not invoking anything like propositional belief, but this like relational thing, which is somehow invoking trust or something else, right? And we can also note that in English, we talk of knowing a person, where it looks like that's not encoding some kind of relationship to a proposition. So, as I said earlier on, right, and none of you balked at it whatsoever, there are some of you in this room that I know, there are some of you that I don't. You seem to know what I was talking about when I said that, but what is that thing? What is that? This is actually an area that epistemologists have almost never talked about. And I think there's going to be something very important that you might be able to say in the religious epistemology context once you get that sorted out. Suppose we call that, you know a subject, you know someone personally, is what we sometimes say, right? Suppose we call that interpersonal knowledge. But where we, just for the sake of argument, say that that doesn't consist in knowledge of a proposition about the person, although it might well involve that. But it involves something else. It's kind of, instead of a propositional knowledge, is mind to proposition or mind to world fit or something, right? It's mind to mind. It's knowledge of a subject as a subject, where perhaps that also involves that they know you too. We don't need to take a stand on that, but that's, I think, a very natural thing to say. Once we grant something like that, once we get something going about how that would work out in a general case, we might be able to say that it's possible for someone to know that there is a God, say by way of deductive argument. Well, there's several kinds of deductive arguments for the existence of God, and some, you know, against the existence of God. And you might, if it's possible to know God on the basis of that, you might know that there's a God without knowing God interpersonally. But conversely, you also might know God interpersonally without knowing that there's a God. And how could that happen? Well, you know, you might think that knowledge that there's a God requires a whole bunch of other knowledge on your part. You know, sometimes whatever the basis is for knowing that, suppose there's no deductive arguments that you know of, but also the means by which you know would come to know that there's a God is just kind of, in the language of some philosophy done in epistemology done here at Oxford, you know, if knowledge that P requires a safe method for believing P, it might be that there are too many bad companions in the method by which you came to believe P, or the way which you came to believe that there's a God. And depending on your view of revelation, your view of scriptural authority, and so on, you might have this kind of viewing. thing in view. There's just too many bad companions, such that I might believe all kinds of falsehoods in the neighborhood, even if a bunch of the stuff that I do believe is true. And so you might think, I believe, you know, I could believe that there's a God, even if that falls short of knowledge. Nevertheless, I could have this interpersonal knowledge of God as a subject, where also God knows me as a subject. And maybe there's a lot of work for the religious epistemology to be done on this. This is my view. That there's a lot of work to be done. Last bit, before I ask some questions or let you ask some questions. Notice that Jesus' answer, I'm going to give you Maimonides' talk of the first commandment, not that that's the greatest commandment. So when Jesus is asked in a couple of the Gospels, what is the greatest commandment? His answer is the bit from Deuteronomy, right? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. If that's what's required of you from God, you might think it's very difficult to love a being which you don't know personally. Now, maybe it's possible. You can grow up all kinds of ways in which you might love people who you've never met or people you don't know and so on. You might act and do things that are loving toward them. But I don't think the acting and doing where you love a being is what God has in mind, just that. It looks like the kind of thing that Jesus was talking about is a very interpersonal thing. Like, loving with all your mind and soul and strength looks like it really presupposes a kind of like knowledge of the being, where that's a kind of interpersonal knowledge. So I suspect that there's some work to be done on that. But that's not to say that I know how it would fit in with the notion of faith, or what faith would involve, whether faith is even interesting as an epistemological category, whether your evidence fits with faith, what. So I'm going to stop it there. But I'm going to give you a few questions, and I want you to think about them. And you know, if you don't want to answer my questions, that's fine, because if you have your own questions to ask, that's fine. But the first question is, this one I've already asked, should we think of belief or knowledge or evidence or faith or maybe something else? There are other notions that epistemologists worry about, like understanding. What's understanding? Haven't touched on that, but you know, we don't need to get into it necessarily. Ought one of those to be viewed as central to the religious believer? Second, what should we say about evidence for the existence of God, as well as evidence against the existence of God? You know, underneath a lot of this talk is this idea, and I said this thing from Kant and from other, you know, it looks like a lot of religious believers want to say, knowledge is going to be hard to come by, knowledge that there's a God. Maybe for a variety of reasons, maybe because of religious pluralism and disagreement on these issues, maybe because your view of scriptural authority is, you know, one that grants that there could be a lot of fallible human processes involved or something. But what about the other side? So it looks like we'd want to say, hopefully, the same thing. Suppose there's no God. How easy would it be to know that there's no God? If it's hard to know that there's a God, should it be hard also on the flip side to say it would be hard to know that there's no God if there's no God? What kind of evidence would there be, maybe is there, even if there's a God, against the existence of God? This is the kind of thing that I think religious believers don't take seriously enough sometimes. And as an epistemologist, I have to take them seriously, so I want to push them back and to take it seriously. Another question, the last one I'll say here. Is knowing God as a subject or interpersonally relevant here? Should we care about that? Or should we just do the propositional thing, propositional epistemology? Should we care about knowledge that there's a God, or belief that there's a God, and maybe faith that there's a God, and not worry about this other dimension of reason? Okay, I'll stop there, and I'll let you ask questions or raise. I want this to be sort of like a discussion where people chime in, people even talk to each other here. So we have actually Carl do some of the field questions. But yeah, that's it. You get the blue chair.
You should have
it. No, that's okay.
Hi, thanks for the talk. I enjoyed it. I suspect that most religious believers don't arrive at a faith in God through the traditional inductive or deductive arguments.
But they do or they don't?
They don't, uh-huh. I suspect. And to that extent, I can see some virtue in Plantinga's work and also earlier. Thomas Reed, I think, sort of fights back against Enlightenment rationalism, saying, well, this isn't actually how we arrive at true belief. And I guess to an extent, it's a Pauline argument. Paul says, well, God's existence is self-evident. But I suppose if you're talking about God as a proposition, it's quite a fleshless God in that sense. What do we mean by God? I suppose that's as serious, needs filling out conceptually, and that's a serious part of the epistemological question, I think, mm-hmm. because Robespierre and the French Revolution would have no issue talking about a supreme being, a God, and it's very different talking about a Christian God. So I suppose what I'm wondering is how much work is done in terms of looking at, I suppose, what you might call a coherentist model, where there is a series of propositions, and I suppose as a Christian you want to have a series of biblical propositions about the world and what it would look like, and I suppose it's been most pithily put by C.S. Lewis when he said, "I don't believe in God. I believe in God for the same reason I believe in the sun rising in the morning, not because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." And it seems to me that that kind of coherentist model of bringing the most kind of acute realities of life into focus through this lens of scripture or a body of belief is actually probably why most people resonate with the faith.
Can you say, for the benefit of everyone else, what do you mean when you say a coherentist model?
Sure. I mean,
and for me,
to be honest with you, I'm using it in the broadest sense, as opposed to a particular stream of coherentist philosophy. I'm not sure I necessarily subscribe to everything. Somewhere between realism and anti-realism, I think it's a kind of philosophical stream of coherentist philosophy. But I mean it in a broad term as looking at the world as I said, it's having a series of propositions, and it makes the world holistically, is maybe the better term. You assess a body of belief holistically, and assessing how most coherently, whether it makes coherent your experience of the world, your I suppose. Lived experience of the world, sort of work about a posteriori.
Yeah, good. Thanks. That's good. On the one hand, there's a couple of things that get run together in this kind of discussion, and it might help for some aims of the conversation to keep them distinct. So. One way of talking about coherence in this sense is to talk about this series of propositions taken as a whole, or at least a minimal number of them, have to be taken on board at the same time in order for them to then sort of ramify out to how I ought to adjust my beliefs or change my credences or think that I require some evidence for believing some further thing. The minimal case, the sort of limit case of that is just the one proposition, like, there's a God, but the first thing you led with was, what do we mean by that, and what does that involve?
Yeah.
And that's a very good question. It's the kind of thing that philosophers of religion haven't really gotten clear on, partly because, to put it bluntly, the God of the philosophers is a different kind of God than the God of most revealed religions. And so, it's not really embedded, say, in the Christian tradition that God has to be omniscient in some strictly philosophically interesting epistemological sense, or God has to be omnipotent in some, you know. There are going to be ways of fleshing out those notions individually, which then give you a different portrait of God, and then the question becomes, if I'm even interested in this stuff, which one do I take on board? And then the question is, what do I look to decide that question? Do I look to, say, tradition? Do I look to reason? Do I look to like my experience that's supposed to make sense of these options? And what we have is this, as it were, chicken and egg, not chicken and egg, but like this question of where do we start? Do we start with certain assumptions about the package that has to be brought on? Do we start with like the authority of some sacred text? Do we start with how I respond to that text? And I take it that there's just no, I mean, even amongst theologians, I mean, you're going to get some who'd say that there is the way to do it. But they typically have very impoverished things to say about the other ways that they're not endorsing.
So I suppose, but you've sort of put it to the religious side, you know, we've got to take epistemological concerns seriously, just apply that, I suppose, from the religious side. Is there a sense in which God conceptually is beyond the kind of linguistic or conceptual scope by definition of epistemology? I know there's certain apophatic, you know, streams of religion which might make such arguments, but as an epistemologist, you know, we don't want to get into, you know, maybe you don't want to get into sort of abject fideism.
I mean, it's just there are a bunch of choice points here, and the question is what you should start with.
Yeah.
If you want to start with a tradition that's apophatic, that only tells you the things you can, I mean, the way I'm glossing that is only tells you the things you cannot say about God.
Yeah.
You can only try to use negative as well, negative properties of God. That's some place you can start.
Mm.
It's very difficult to assess the appropriateness of starting in place.
Mm.
Because if it's really a starting place, it's not the kind of thing that's amenable to reasons for starting there.
Yeah. Cool.
So I don't think that's actually, I think that's a problem, as it were, for everyone. One thing we can't actually, at least in the way I've led the discussion at least, we can't get away from the way we actually already think about knowledge, and the way we already think about belief, and the way we already maybe think about evidence or reasons or the rationality of deploying those, at least in some settings.
Yeah.
Now maybe you make a judgment about, in the theological or in the religious setting, those just don't have the same kind of purchase. Maybe you're inclined to a tradition where that's just, you know, it's a, like maybe a fideistic one. It's one that leans hard on the revealed theology so as to make sense of all that other stuff. This is a bit like the Lewis quote. What's tricky about that is that looks like it's also involved in a kind of explanatory argument. God is like, you know, in the way that the sun's position in the solar system and how it governs my day-to-day life and so on, as is kind of crucial for understanding a whole bunch of other things about the way I understand the empirical world. Where God fits in is somehow explanatory for me for how I go about understanding the rest of the world. And that's the kind of thing that's just very, very, I mean, I'm going to be honest, because just that's where we come down on those and decide to start from looks like it's very hard to assess in a rational manner. I mean, people do it. You can do various studies of, you know, different ways of trying to do, say, theology or think about revealed traditions and so on. And it looks like you're just going to be invoking the standard epistemological kind of stuff, like either the way this strikes me, which isn't exactly rational. You open the Bible and something about Jesus just hits you a certain way, like, that's not really something we can do. Like, oh, you shouldn't do that. I mean, maybe people can do that, but. Or you can say, no, this is like part of my inference to the best explanation of what the right way to think about God is, because I studied all this other stuff. It's hard. These are hard questions. It's not clear, like,
when you get to those foundational kinds of issues, what you should say.
Can I ask you a follow-up? And then I was just going to ask, as an epistemologist, how do ethics sort of fit into this picture? Because you mentioned the ethics of belief, and I'm thinking, like, in response to what you were saying just now about, you know, sort of starting points, I guess for my own faith, it kind of makes the most sort of moral sense of the world. And when I see Christ and this idea of sacrifice, especially, it really just kind of nails my intuitions and I think the better parts of my humanity. And I guess that's what I kind of lean on in both when I struggle, you know, with faith, but also when I just sort of explain to other people, hey, you know, this is sort of what my faith is about. It has a heavy moral dimension. I mean, it's qualified, at least qualified by being rationally coherent, but it's always the moral aspect which speaks to me as a human being, I guess, that really kind of pushes me or sort of gets me started. And so I guess I was wondering if that, sort of how that fits together. And I guess, so for me, so when I hear, you know, when I look at an organization like ISIS or something like this, and the kind of radical religion that's, you know, spoken of there, like belief, and I just think that's wrong. It's, you know, I mean, I don't have rational grounds necessarily for it. I mean, that's sort of gets more complicated. But it just sort of basically, as a human being, I'm completely happy to just rule that out. Anyway, so that's just kind of a comment, a kind of a question, in the sense of like, how do ethics fit into this sort of picture of belief and like starting points?
That's good. It's a good question, because the way I was talking might have been taken in such a way that I was only talking at a theoretical level about these matters, where in fact, I mean, it looks like you can have, so your guy, Kant, has these great, I think of them as quite great, moral arguments for the existence of God. So that's just to concede that you can have the moral practical bits figure in, say, reasons for belief, but they have to be fitting in the right kinds of ways. So those kinds of arguments are sort of, maybe they can be construed deductively, or maybe they can just be construed as inference to the best explanation of how you, but the kinds of reasons being invoked are moral ones. That's a different thing from saying, there are ways in which moral facts would not be appropriate to use in certain kinds of justification. It depends on how they relate to the legal question. So, just like practical facts are arguably maybe not supposed to be practical incentives, like some of you might be aware of Pascal's wager, right? It's like, looks like that's a kind of the candidate watershed kind of case where it's like, look, Pascal can point to all the ways in which belief in God could pay off for me, but that doesn't look like the right kind of reason to move me to belief, because it's not the right kind of thing that plays an evidential role. I can't appropriately believe something just because I get told, here's $1 million for it, in it for you, if you're right, you know. That doesn't look like the right kind of motivating reason. In some kinds of cases, though, moral propositions can play the right kind of motivating reason for belief, particularly when it has to do with God, where it's tied into supposed to be tied into the nature of such a being, what that being would tell us about how to live, and so on. So I didn't mean for it to actually be the kind of thing that rules that out. But again, this gets into very tricky territory, because dividing the line between practical and theoretical reasons gets messy. It's hard to know exactly how to do it. Was it?
Thank you for the talk. If justified true belief requires resonance with how the world is, and you're dealing with someone whose only perception of the world, based on their experience, as it were, their education, whatever it might be, is the material universe, and therefore they require evidence which is empirical. and can be measured, et cetera, through the scientific method. Mm-hmm. How do we approach people with that worldview, that mindset, when it comes to the question of God?
You have to point out to them that the thing that, say, you might believe that they clearly don't believe is the kind of thing that can't obviously be built up out of or reached through looking at empirical truths. Now, you could lean hard on them and say, no, maybe they could. Look at history. Look how history works. The kinds of positions we are in with respect to all kinds of historical facts are ones for which we don't have empirical access to, like in the first person sense. Like, even if I have first person access to the imprint of your boot in the mud, which suggests to me that you had walked by here 2 hours ago or something, that's not the kind of empirical access that those people are typically interested in claiming. And then when you just take the history and just move away back even further, you can show them that, look, if you're going to go really hard on requiring empirical evidence, you need to tell us what you mean by empirical evidence, but it's likely that the kind of empirical evidence they have in mind requires widespread skepticism, say, about the past or something. But, I mean, you know, a certain kind of, say, Christian could then say, look, we have very strong, maybe historical grounds for thinking there's this guy Jesus, blah, blah, and go from there. And these are going to be the kinds of empirical facts that are going to challenge the role of naturalism. But I think, actually, the tougher way to do it is, but the more straightforward way is just call into question why you'd be a naturalist, why you'd be a materialist. Presumably what they have in mind is something like this epistemological issue, like, this is the stuff I have most close access to, or this is the stuff I can be most sure of. But again, there's all kinds of stuff that you're going to be overly sure of if that's your epistemological model. For example, are there other minds? I mean, you don't have access on that model in the right kind of way to be very sure of where there are other minds. You also don't have access to the reliability of your memories. I mean, you don't have access to a whole host of stuff, right? So what you got to do, I think, is you play the epistemology game with them and you point out to them where their commitments look like they leave. There are also kinds of metaphysical stuff you can deal with, like naturalism looks like, I mean, there are lots of arguments which suggest that naturalism is actually a notion that can't be well defined. So if it's a certain kind of philosopher arguing than a philosopher, there's a bunch of tricks you pull out. But like, I think the normal kind of thing is just this other person's like, I just want to operate as a materialist because, like, well, that's the stuff that's around me. But there's all kinds of stuff they're committed to. It's not around them. Once you can show them that, then it looks like the ground they were on is not as sturdy as they thought. And then, you know, that's not going to lead them to being a theist necessarily. That's a way into the discussion.
Brad, and then
is that like a follow up on that? Or?
Yeah, I just wanted some clarification on the discussion previous that was talking about the justification of religious propositions. So, and then I may have a follow-up question after this. But as far as the whole coherentism foundationalist debate, what is your view as far as what fits in better with religious epistemology?
I don't think it's really helpful to invoke either model. I mean, There are gonna be things we believe that are based on the things we believe. That's all you need to concede to both such views. But then, I mean, you could, on a foundationalist picture, you're just gonna say there's things in the foundation that just sort of stop their regress. There's nothing on which they're based. And those are the things on which everything turns. And one of the very first questions is like, look, I mean, the form of epistemology kind of
discussion. It's like you allow God into that foundation as being a rational thing, then you can see how that ramifies outward and helps explain a bunch of other stuff. My own view is not one that, I mean, you don't need actually to take much of a stand on. Epistemology has developed enough in the last 20, 30 years where that debate is not that interesting anymore. And so most of us don't like much care about it. More central is like, do we know, how do we know a lot of stuff? And a lot of that stuff is just, as it were, maybe direct. And so there's no such thing as like questions about the legitimacy of basing, say, beliefs. Sometimes you can base beliefs on other beliefs. But the look of that is just like, that looks better when you have entailments, because what's wrong with basing a belief? P entails Q, what's wrong, and I believe that Q, I can see the connection, no problem with believing Q. That's a kind of basing, but it's different from the foundational sort of model. It's kind of, did I answer the question?
Hi. I'd like to propose an illustration of a Christian's understanding of the relationship between faith, knowledge, and belief, and I really appreciate your comments. So if you go to Athens, you'll see in the Acropolis Museum, right at the foot of the Acropolis, a recreation, in part, of the frieze that stood upon the colonnade on one side of the Acropolis. And you'll see, for instance, so what I'm for those of us who are not very architecturally minded, what I'm talking about is the triangle bit on the building that stands above the columns, if you can picture that, full of statues. And archaeologists have discovered bits and pieces of this over the years, you know, a foot here, a hand here, a part of a sword, etc. And so when you go into the museum, you see all these ordered as the archaeologists, you know, believe them to have been ordered in antiquity, and you'll see a foot of marble and a hand of marble and maybe a bit of the sword of marble. But in between that, you'll see plaster, where archaeologists have posited, you know, that basically that they're recreating what they think the statue was most likely to have been. And it's amazing because you see the plaster with the marble, and all of a sudden you can sort of behold what the Acropolis would have looked like in its glory, at least an image of it, or what it most likely would have been. And so in this illustration, the knowledge would represent the marble, belief would represent what's made of plaster, and faith might represent the picture of them two, of them together. Anyway, I just appreciate your comments on that.
Thanks, yeah. So faith is the larger holistic thing that brings them together?
Yeah, faith. I would say, I suppose faith is the combination of the knowledge that we have with the most likely explanation, with the likely explanation, indeed the most likely explanation that we believe this knowledge would point us toward. That we, for instance, to go back to the analogy, archaeologists would say that, I mean, you'll go to some statues and you'll just see a foot, and that's all you'll see. But you'll see this whole statue, but, you know, because of what they've read, you know, that was written about the architecture, or what they know about similar architecture, they can recreate this plaster statue around it. And so faith, I suppose, would be the combination of knowledge with belief to form what we believe is the most likely and most reasonable understanding.
I like that. I was thinking that the belief bit, probably a lot of people would want to think of, well, there's two ways to talk about that. One is like, well, given what the expert archaeologists know, this is like a very educated guess. Maybe not even a guess. Maybe they just know that the statue had to be like this to get these other pieces together. But maybe you need a lot of expertise to be able to see that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of cultivated epistemic position. But at the very least,
I think a lot of people will want to say that the core plaster bit that's holding them together involves belief. I mean, lots of beliefs, maybe, but maybe some core belief, but that religious faith just is that, that thing itself. And then there's also a bunch of stuff you add on to it, the practices that go along with what the tradition says that belief, you know, if you believe that, you're going to have to do a few things, live a certain way, whatever, it's going to, you can't just pay lip service to it and not. Right? This is something that actually didn't really get discussed, but in religious epistemology, I think it's interesting to point out, like, you get this in, especially in the Christian tradition a lot, but belief is the kind of thing that paradigmatically guides action. So there's no real sense to be made of the idea that you could believe something but not act on it when it comes down to something that on which the thing you believe depends. And I think it's very easy for, especially for comfortable Westerners, like a lot of us are, to have a sort of religious life and then have like a daily life and like sort of not, as it were, you know, live out what the things we believe are supposed to involve. And arguably, like, I actually know a well-known epistemologist who's also a religious believer in the somewhat traditional sense, but who wants to say that most of us just don't believe, say, that Jesus is Lord, or that there's a God. And you can tell by just looking the way we act. It's very condemning, right? I mean,
can I that's a very good way of saying to you that actually this whole discourse is this kind of inadequate. That when we're talking about knowing God, we're not talking about a sanctity position. We're talking about something which has an essential element of
I'm not sure if I want to go with my friend to deny that. That my friend was not denying that religious, the belief is in the wrong category. He's saying he thinks it's the right category, but we indict ourselves by showing a lot of us that we in fact don't believe the things we say.
Yeah. Once you gave it, you were blowing away the whole narrow philosophy. Because you're not now talking about whether you were sent to propositions and whether you have good grounds for assenting propositions. You're talking about how you should live, which is a more classical kind of philosophical analytical philosophy of doing this.
Well, I mean, so if you believe that, suppose you, just take an everyday Simon case. If you read the tutorial you have to teach tomorrow, so at 2 p.m., you're going to act in certain ways with respect to it. And if you don't believe it, you're not going to act in those ways. Unless, you're trying to deceive someone or whatever. But, there are exception kinds of situations. But, I think if I understood where you're going, the kinds of notions that are inherent in epistemology I've been talking about actually just go along with the essential commitment to a certain...
Yeah, you haven't got anything about it. You haven't even got a moral agent.
No, the idea from the beginning is that belief is mental assent to a proposition which is full such that you'd be able to act on it. You'd be willing to act on it.
But that we've now added an extra possible.
That's true. But I did say that, look, if you know, it's going to be safe for you to act on that. It's going to be...
Let's ask a moderate question.
Okay.
Does Jesus have epistemology?
Does Jesus have epistemology? Well, I mean, he has some epistemology. He had beliefs.
What did he not tell us?
He told us things like, he who sees me sees the Father. He who believes in me believes in me. Yeah. There's a lot of that in there. So it's not like...
And he heard faith himself.
He also urged belief.
Yes, belief what he said.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean,
can we bring some of those things in the New Testament into discussion with your friend?
We can. I'm just wanting to make sure we understand that the notion of belief that's operative here makes little sense unless you have a way of tying it to dispositions to act.
You haven't made that case?
I haven't made that case. I'm assuming that.
That's just my view.
No, I'm assuming that precisely because it makes little sense to go anywhere else.
It's covenant philosophy, isn't it?
No, it's not. it's not in the circles in which I run, in which
constant, you know, the moral philosophy makes point.
The moral philosopher who does that typically doesn't believe there are moral facts which are, I mean, maybe they believe there are moral facts which are being being broken by him, but
no,
but
no, there's no connection between teaching.
Teaching is not, I'm talking about belief.
Can't really hear Stuart very well here.
So you can teach all kinds of stuff you don't believe, that's not real. And you can be a certain kind of moral theorist who's a moral realist and just like not care about, you know, the things you take to be moral truths. There's all, I mean, this is to do a whole bunch more philosophy of mind than I was willing to do. If you're gonna have a real notion of what's going on with belief, you're gonna have to say some things about desire, because belief and desire go together. I'm only gonna act on my propositions, I believe, if my desires go along with it, and so on.
That belief is a binary thing. That's not good.
A binary thing such that what?
You either believe or you don't believe. It's obvious of beliefs. So it's very obvious.
Well, that's controversial.
Well, okay.
I set aside earlier the bit about subjects.
That's a psychological question, not a philosophical question.
Which is?
The nature of belief. It's not a faith and prayer question.
It's actually got a lot of a philosophical background to how we're treating empirical phenomena.
But that could all be complete fantasy.
A lot of what philosophers do. I'm happy to grant that.
No, you discuss the same question year after year, and you admit it. This is not fashionable. This is what we're talking about. So you're not talking about knowledge.
Well, I mean, I don't think we're going to want to deny that in psychology or, you know, other empirical sciences, fashion plays no role either, right? I mean, to the extent that we want a philosophical account of what belief involves, such that it plays the right role in our epistemology and in our philosophy of mind, then there are going to be bits of it that are hostage to empirical fortune, but there are others that are not, precisely because the way we interpret the empirical results and the way we set up experiments to test things are going to be laid by the foundation done by philosophy of mind and epistemology. So, I mean,
no,
this is just to return to the very first point, which is...
That's false.
How's
philosophers
that?
Philosophers are commentators. The commentators on the journey which has been carried by the people.
What's that?
Why don't we move on
to
other questions? I think other people, I saw some hands over here. Joe.
On what you were saying about answering the materialist, can I suggest that a slightly simpler way of saying some of the things you were suggesting would be to insist that he be consistent to his theory and continue to challenge where he is not living on the basis of his professed materialist philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Such as, what would be an area where it might be very clear that...
Well, making all of his life based upon that type of philosophy. His moral judgments, his relationship with people, and simply challenge him that his philosophy is not fitting his experience as he lives it.
That'd be a good tack, but it might depend on the person you're talking to.
Yeah, and
because the person might not really have much of a moral sense that they care to. I mean, it might be purely out for number one, and so there's no. There's no real moral compunction about how they act. It's all just sort of, you know.
That's where you need
to the rules.
That's where you need to explore
Yeah.
And try and find out the points where they're not living in God's world as we know it is. Because we can have the confidence, I think, that at some point, the philosophy that someone is operating does not fit with the world as he experiences it.
Yeah, good, that's good. And that's actually a piece with what I was trying to respond in the first place, yeah, because...
And then another thing, you mentioned inference of the best hypothesis a number of times, abduction, which I think is partly what was involved in Lewis's quote about saying things. I think that fits into the category of abduction. And also what Carl mentioned with reference to ethical questions. It seems to me that ethical questions are part of the larger picture that we actually use for inference to the best hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like it to make a suggestion that most of our conclusions when we have thought through something is on the basis of abduction. There are only a handful of things, mathematics and pure logic, that are pure deduction.
Mm-hmm.
And a great deal of science is not simply induction, it's abduction. That this is a huge part, the biggest part of how we come to conclusions about things. The other part, which may be even larger, is testimony. Most of what we believe on the basis of testimony. Not because we've done the experiments, not because we've worked ourselves through this sets of logical conclusions, but on the basis of being told and trusting what we're told. So this leads me to wonder, instead of in epistemology trying to analyze what belief is or faith, has anyone tried to instead say what trust is?
Oh yeah.
It's a topic that's heating up very much. And it's at the intersection of people who work a bit in epistemology and also a bit in ethics. And not just ethics, but like branches of moral and social philosophy that are concerned with interpersonal relationships, which a lot of ethics is more concerned with kind of like developing a system for what morality or making the right moral choice would involve, which need not necessarily appeal to interpersonal relationships.
Stuart's point, trust is not just in the area of morals. That's at the heart of what a Christian means by faith and belief, that we don't mean merely a belief that. As the letter of James says, the demons believe that God is one. And shut it. There's no trust. There's no commitment. There's no love.
Yeah.
And so, as Christians, we can't be content with an epistemological analysis that is simply on the level of belief that and justifying that belief. It has to become more involved in the area of trust,
mm-hmm.
and in the whole area of abduction, which I'm find a more realistic description of how we come to conclusions.
I agree with everything that you just said, in part because epistemologists, philosophers of science work on it a bit, but people in epistemology don't work as much as they should on the nature of inference to the best explanation, how to do it well. But the kind of question, I think, in epistemology, at least for, not necessarily for professional epistemologists that work on religious epistemology, but it nonetheless looms there. But for everyday people considering whether to believe, say, that there's a God or to take a religion seriously or what have you, one of the questions is whether to try to prioritize belief that before trusting, or just to trust in the hopes that the thing that might be believed is there. Because in everyday cases, it looks like a little bit weird to say, oh, it'd be rationally acceptable for me to trust, you know, so-and-so when I don't even know if there is a so-and-so. I don't even believe if there's a so-and-so. There's a sense in which, and it doesn't need to be this way, but it's very natural to think, the belief that question comes first, and then once you've got that, the question about whether trust comes next. I'm not endorsing that idea, I'm just saying, like, it's a very natural way to proceed. You wonder whether there could be such a being, and then you wonder whether that being is deserving of your trust. But that is tricky, because it leads back to the very first question. The question is like, what is this being, what would it be like? If it's part and parcel of that being, it's loving, and essentially so, and perfectly good. That's a different thing from some other, you know, philosophical conception of God.
Yeah. And that's where testimony comes in. Whether you trust the person telling you.
That begs the question, doesn't it?
It depends on, I mean, if you're getting that from another religious believer versus, do you think it's coming from that?
It's just a regress of authority.
But it's only a part of the whole picture coming to a conclusion. Part of the bigger picture is Jesus is, by their fruits you shall know.
So I was going to ask a question earlier, but you may have already answered it since I put your hand up. But I think a common way, and I'm not necessarily endorsing this, but I think a common way people see faith, or like when it's a Christian faith in God, is there has to be this kind of absence of like certainty, or knowledge somehow precludes. In the absence of knowledge, we have to kind of make this existential commitment and this choice to believe. And knowledge somehow kind of pushes in on that, and is if we just know something propositionally, then you know, we don't need to kind of like commit to it or something. It just kind of.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question was what could we gain by not just calling but somehow arguing, making a case for knowledge. God or something like this, or if we were to say we don't just have faith in the absence of knowledge, but we have knowledge and something else. Does that make sense?
Knowledge of which?
Knowledge that there is a God. Knowledge of sort of, I guess, basic tenets of Christian doctrine, these sorts of things.
I mean, I've been smoothing over really rough what's really actually not so clear in some of the areas of epistemology, and something that actually touches on this. So like, you can have different views of knowledge and of belief where it's the kind of thing that under certain kinds of pressure, it comes and goes. Now, you might think that's just a reductio of the idea that it was there in the first place. But, you know, if you're the kind of, if you like a model on which you can have outright belief or something, but you get nervous about your evidence, and then you thereby drop yourself down to some credence or something. You know, that often follows from it then with this sense that, like, well, I'd be risking much if I went ahead and acted as if I knew, or went ahead and did this thing that would have been very easy for me if I outright believed. I mean, this is what I think is, some of you touched on this, and it's supposed to be there from the beginning, this idea that faith packages with it this notion of risk. And I was thinking as well, faith packages with it the idea of trust and trusting commitment to a person. It doesn't, there are ways in which you can do that, it doesn't mean that. But that's all there. It's an open question, I think, whether that needs to be incompatible with knowledge. Or if you're just going to say a bunch of things about some knowledge is had, some is not, in the ideal situation we'd have, you know, be able to have lots more knowledge, but, you know, the religious picture, at least in Christianity, is God requires of us this trusting faith. In the absence of that, and maybe that's constitutive of what it is to have that. Be able to do that in the conditions of non-ideal or evidence or absolute position or something, because that's, you know, Lewis has this really cool paper called On Obstinacy in Belief, where he makes a point kind of like this. C.S. Lewis. Where he's like, he distinguishes between when you, the difference between what it takes, as it were, to acceptably come to believe that there's a God, and then what it takes after you have that, when you have this kind of trusting belief in sort of relationship with the demands, or whatever you want to call it, for evidence or for the right kind of position, change once you're in, once you've gone in, and the trust takes over, it's more central. So you can have actually places for both on a picture like that. I've actually been thinking there's actually no really plausible way to get rid of any of these notions except maybe knowledge. When it comes to these topics, the self knowledge system.
I've always thought philosophy is fascinating, especially because it gets into so many, you can't just talk about one field, you have to, as you said, talk about philosophy of mind, or, I've always been interested in what comes first, metaphysics or epistemology. Do I need an epistemology of metaphysics to start metaphysics? Do I first need to go to epistemology? Or is it the other way, and is it an endless regress that just keeps on going? What is your personal view?
I mean, as with a lot of these questions, including the first one, you need to presuppose a bit of one, or maybe of both, in order to get started. I think it's hard to try and do much epistemology without at least having a sort of candidate on at least ontology or metaphysical presuppositions that go with an ontology set in place, even if you're not like wedded to it, right? So, in one way, I think metaphysics is a little bit prior, but you can get into issues where you're just going to make you reassess based on epistemological. It's a very tricky question. This is the very first philosophy kind of question, and I don't think I have a real good take on what would make for good answers now.
Thanks for the presentation. Mine is just the general question for all of us to think about. It helps your experience.
Can you speak more about it, please?
I'm saying mine is just a general question, something that you can think about, but I'm directing it to you because you probably have been in this field for quite a long time. Something just that you can think about. If indeed God, the God that you are talking about, that where all of us believe in, those of us who are here, if he's indeed God, what is the likelihood of what is the likelihood of you being able to put him on a science level, a social science level, dissect him, be able to identify him, like, and peg him, if indeed he is God and treated everything in the same way? I mean, is it not something that is perceived as difficult, because if he's there, it means we may not be able to fully unpack him, unless we treat him as an object.
Yeah.
I think that is some kind of an object, which will, of course, not fit into what generally Christians believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good question. That's a very good question.
I mean, how you approach that depends a little bit on what your view of. So you might have a view of revelation on which God's revealed a lot about who God is, even though at some ultimate level, God's very difficult, maybe impossible for us to understand. God nevertheless imparts certain things which are supposed to be useful to us to be able to live appropriately, live well. and also to be in relationship. You know, you can have, apophaticism was already mentioned here, and I mean, you can have maybe theological reasons for supposing that in fact, that they're going to drive your notion of how much God reveals of God's self, which God keeps hidden, whether the nature of that would even let us know at all. But, I mean, I think this... I'll just say, I think it'd be hard to be a Christian. And I focus on Christian. I mean, focus on Christianity because I'm a Christian, but also because it's one of the very few religions that has something very particular concrete to say about this, which is like God's incarnated for us to sort of, as it were, touch and learn from directly. It would be very strange to have what is a distinctively Christian view about God and God's reasons for doing that, but also maintain a serious and total distance about what we can know about God. Because the whole picture is supposed to be God did this not, you know, to die for our sins and there's, you know, sanctification, there's all that. But there's this obvious epistemological thing. God reveals himself to us, to people, so that we can know a bit about him better than we knew before. Nevertheless, I suppose most Christians would also say there's a serious humility that has to be involved, especially when you're doing theology, which is like, you know, the more you try to probe what those core doctrines about the incarnation, Trinity, and so on involve, how far you can get the kind of understanding you'd like maybe to have. And I think some of that humility might just come out in the idea that you really know very little about what God's like precisely because it's just so hard. And that's a different thing from saying there aren't good grounds for, say, endorsing or believing certain doctrines or something like that, or not really, really living as if Jesus wants us to live this way, or, you know, whatever. But yeah, that's, I think, if for the Christian theologian or for the Christian non-theologian, that's actually what is.
Okay, last question.
Yeah, so, going back to the coherence theories, I was just thinking, what is your view on correspondence theories of truth and like how can we use that, for instance, in empirical studies, not empirical, but like maybe historical studies on, say, events like the resurrection to convince somebody else? Or, you know, how does that relate to postmodernist concepts on what we've discussed regarding epistemology?
Where by postmodern you mean anti-realist sort of reason?
Non-anti-realist.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent that I've studied these kinds of debates over truth, I've never really seen... I mean, there are ways of tripping oneself up when one tries to explain what is meant by the correspondence theory of truth, but I've never really seen much that makes me want to think of, you have to go to something else.
Right.
So like, I kind of like correspondence.
Okay.
And it's a little bit, coherence theories of truth make me kind of worried that you're just conflating the metaphysics and the epistemology. You're like, well, I'm in this position where I can't quite discern what to say, so I'll take on a coherence theory of truth. And what's true is supposed to be what like looks like the best thing to say. But like, I mean, I'm a realist enough to say, look, whether it's true has to do with the way the world is, not anything having to do with you.
Mm.
So like, you might get closer or further from it, you might approximate it better or worse. Aquinas has this stuff about the kind of notion of correspondence where it comes in degrees is adquatio, an equation of the mind and reality, but nevertheless, even if you can make sense of a graded notion, what it would be for it to be, as well, true,
right,
fully true, is for it to, reality to be that way. So, I mean, I don't want to sound dismissive of this debate, but I've never quite, they've never taken the traction, neither they have lots of other philosophers. So. And I don't know, I mean, I think in general, the kinds of background stuff about theology and so on, you can just, it's very easy to kind of get anyone on board with this kind of realism. It's like, look, whether there's a God is, looks like it's a fact that, it's a fact, you know, apart from what any of us think about it. You can run that with all kinds of putative facts. And then the issue is just grounds for thinking this is the fact rather than that, then it's negation. That's an example. So, I'm not sure if that really actually
answers
your question.
Your position, yeah.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much, Matt.